This is the fifth day of this April 2018 7-day session. We'll return to our book called The Practice of Zen by C.C. Chang. These are translated teachings of various Chinese masters. The one we left off when was Discourses of Master Po Chan, which may be something of the 1500s, maybe. No date given. He continues, "The masters of old said, Tao, like the great void, is all-inclusive. It lacks nothing, and nothing remains in it." And then Po Shan says, "If one has really attained the state of flexible hollowness, he sees no world without and no body or mind within. Only then can he be considered as having drawn near the entrance of the way." There's a footnote, a lengthy footnote, after this phrase, flexible hollowness. If one has really attained the state of flexible hollowness, the translator admits that it's a clumsy translation, but the best he could come up with. And what he's trying to translate is samadhi, state of no self. Flexible because there's no self standing apart. Hollow because there's nothing or no one of any substance. It's a very positive thing, of course. There's no resistance. There's no opposition, no feeling of resistance or opposition. Maybe the next closest thing would be this term of clouds and water. That kind of adaptability, of accommodating oneself to whatever the circumstances are, not setting oneself apart. It's a very pure course, a very pure state. One is free of thoughts of self and free of other dualisms as well. He says, no world without and no body or mind within. In other words, no inside or outside. It lacks nothing. Okay, so everything is included, and nothing remains in it. Here's where words become so limiting. There's no in. Nothing remains in it, because one sees that all phenomena are devoid of any substance. He continues, "In days of old, people often drew circles of lime on the ground to signify determination that until they realized the ultimate truth, they would never go outside of the circle. Nowadays, people frivolously draw circles in wanton folly, pretending they possess a free and lively spirit. How laughable this is." Well, the Buddha, when he crossed his legs underneath the Bodhi tree, did just that. He didn't. There's no evidence that he drew a circle around himself, but what he said was, "Never will I stir from this seat until I attain full enlightenment." But no doubt, these guys were such wild characters. These people of ancient times, there no doubt were, what he says is true, there were those who drew circles around themselves, and these are the serious ones, and then didn't leave until they had come to awakening. And then it became a kind of a thing to do, and these frivolous monks would do it. If during your work you experience comfort or lightness, or come to some understanding or discovery, you must not assume that these things constitute true realization. Some time ago, I, Poshan, worked on the fairy monk's koan, Leaving No Trace. One day, while reading the book of The Transmission of the Lamp, I came upon the story in which Zhao Zhou told a monk, "You have to meet someone 3,000 miles away to get it." At that, I felt as if I had dropped the 1,000-pound burden and believed that I had attained great realization. But when I met Master Pao Feng, I soon saw how ignorant I was, and I became very ashamed of myself. Thus you should know that even after one has attained Satori, awakening, and feels safe and comfortable, he still cannot consider the work done until he has consulted a teacher. Yeah, this is, of course, time-honored custom in Zen to offer a student who feels that she or he has had some kind of a breakthrough questions by which the teacher wants to discern whether there has really been a genuine breakthrough or whether it is some elevated state, some makyo or side effect of strong sitting. In my first or second, third, I can't remember, one of my early sashins in the early 70s, I was so feverishly greedy for Kensho that I worked myself up into some kind of a bizarre state, and on the last afternoon of the sashin, the seventh day, I convinced myself that I had some kind of awakening, and I went to the head monitor at the time and said, "I can't sit anymore. I've had an awakening," which is pretty much a giveaway there of what what that amounted to. And he, having never had any awakening himself, just nodded seriously and then got me into the final doksan. Got me in to the line and went before Roshi Kaplow, and he asked me three questions that I answered without hesitating, very quickly and authoritatively, and he very kindly said, "Well, Peter, I don't know what you've got, but it's not Kensho." And then he thought I would be so deflated that I would just not want to go back. Well, I had said to the monitor that I couldn't sit anymore, so he said, "Really, it would be good, you know, for you to finish the sashin," and which I had no problem doing that. I went and sat until the end of the sashin. But these states that come about through intense meditation can be so deceptive. And there are people who, having been told that, no, that's not the real thing, it's something else, some other state of mind you've got yourself into, don't accept it and disappear. There have been a couple, three cases of this in the Zen Center where you never saw the person again because they were so convinced that the teacher was wrong. It's a very, very fine line with most first experiences or openings as to whether it's a genuine entering the gate or whether it's just something masking as that. He continues, Zen work does not consist in merely reciting a koan. What is the use of repeating a sentence again and again? The primary thing is to arouse the doubt sensation, no matter what koan you are working on. I've said this so many times, but I'll briefly say it again. There are people who report that they just can't seem to arouse any questioning, or what questioning they try feels artificial. And in those cases, I say just then don't try to contrive some questioning. Just get fully concentrated on the koan, and hopefully the questioning will arise as time goes on through the intense concentration on it. I think the most important thing he's saying is what not to do. Don't just repeat the word or sentence. Don't just repeat it over and over in a mechanical way. Even if it's not a question, it needs to be need to really look into it. Maybe it's like the difference between just staring at the koan, let's say the koan's mu, just staring at the word mu, the way we might stare out the window absentmindedly at a bird or something. The difference between staring at it and really peering at it, looking into it fiercely, that's quite a difference between those two. In other words, there has to be energy. There has to be an engagement with it, not just having it in front of one. Or, as he says now in this next paragraph, to bore into. He says, when working on Zen, it is important not to lose the right thought. This, I think, is a mistranslation. It's not a thought. I'll just keep reading. This is the thought of Tsen, T-S-E-N, meaning to bore into. That's not a thought. That's a mode or a quality of energy. If one loses the thought of Tsen, he is bound to go astray. Some Zen practitioners absorb themselves in quiet meditation and cling to the feeling of quietness and limpidity. They regard this experience of absolute purity, devoid of a speck of dust, as the Dharma. But this is just what I mean by losing the right thought and straying into lucid serenity, or the right spirit of it, I think is a better, the right spirit of this working. Some practitioners regard the consciousness soul that reads, talks, sits, and moves as the prime concern of Buddhism. This also is going astray. Consciousness, soul, self, maybe? Of course, that's going astray. Some who suppress distracted thought and stop its arising consider this to be Buddhism. They, however, are going astray by using delusory thought to suppress delusory thought. It is like trying to press down the grass with a rock or to peel the leaves of a plantain one after another. There is no end. Some visualize the body-mind as space or bring the arising thoughts to a complete stop like a standing wall, but this also is going astray. Going back to the beginning of this paragraph, talking about the spirit of boring into. Well, this is one way of becoming one with the koan. It sort of resonates with what I was just saying, peering at the koan, looking into the koan. It's not the only way, though, to become one with the koan. It's a different way is to have a sense of merging, not boring into, but merging with, melting into, embracing, sinking into, settling into. However, one can come up with a way to overcome this illusory separation of subject and object, oneself and the koan, or the breath. Doesn't matter. Object, subject, object. Whatever it takes, whatever way you can come up with to do that, it's fine. You can even see the koan as your lover. Roshi Kapo once said, doing zazen, deep zazen, is like making love to the universe. He continues, when working on Zen, to merely arouse the doubt sensation is not enough. One must break right through it. If he cannot seem to do so, he must put forth all his strength, strain every nerve, and keep on trying. This too, this advice to put forth all your strength and strain every nerve can work for some people. Other people, it can leave them feeling tied in knots or just overly tense. And that's where you can try one of these other ways of becoming one with Mu. There has to be the attention, of course, but there doesn't have to be straining. There shouldn't be physical straining because it's just not effective. It may work for a short period of time, but then you end up feeling depleted if you're physically straining. But there is definitely a very strong bringing one's attention to, maybe a meticulous attention to. I think it was the Buddha who used the analogy of a knot. You have a knot that you'll say, let's make it in your shoelace. You have a knot, you don't just tug as hard as you possibly can. It's not going to work. You have to look closely at the knot. Peer very closely. Bring your whole attention to see it. So much attention that you forget everything around you. And then work with it. when working on Zen, some people, owing to their incapability of raising the doubt sensation, begin to suppress the arising of thoughts. When all thoughts have been suppressed, these people experience a lucid and pure serenity, thoroughly clear, without the light, without the slightest taint. This, however, constitutes the very root source of the consciousness which they cannot break through. This is the consciousness within the realm of life and death. It is not Zen. So this is, in other words, it's an attempt to manipulate the mind, to control it in a manipulative way, which can't be correct. It can't be the way that is long term. You can get yourself into a certain kind of state. Maybe that's what I got into on that last day of Sesshin, but it doesn't really lead to real illumination. And then when working on Zen, if one can bring forth a doubt sensation, he is then in conformity with the principle of the Dharmakaya. He sees, I'm going to change, it doesn't have to always be he, I'm going to make it she. She sees the whole earth brightly illuminated without the slightest obstacle. But if she assumes that this is the Tao and is unwilling to release it, she sits only on one side of the Dharmakaya and is unable to cut off the root of life. It seems to her that there is still something in the Dharmakaya to understand, something that can be taken hold of and enjoyed. She does not realize that such thoughts are childish. Because such a person has not cut off the life root, that is the cause, the original cause of life and death, birth and death, samsara, she is sick through and through. This is not Zen. If one reaches this state, she should put all of her body and mind into the work and take up this great matter, still knowing that no one is there to take it up. This is a very, very important point. It seems to her that there is still something in the Dharmakaya to understand, something that can be taken hold of and enjoyed. That is, this is what is so absolutely unfathomable about the Dharma, is that there's nothing there. There's nothing there. There's a scroll in my quarters at Arnold Park, a scroll that was in the same place when Roshi Kaplo lived there. It's a calligraphy by the assistant Roshi at Hoshinji Temple in Japan. And what it says is, from the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. What? How can that be? There's never... Look, this, we look around. All these things everywhere. There's never been a single thing. A single thing of any enduring substance. There's never been a single thing that isn't in flux in a way that we can't perceive with our senses. There's never been a single thing that isn't actually a no thing. And he quotes someone. He says, the masters of ancient times said, bravely let go your hold on the cliff. Throw yourself into the abyss with decision and courage. You only revive after death. these kinds of statements can sound alarming to some people. All he's saying is, let go your hold on your thoughts. Throw yourself into that which is beyond thought. Throw yourself into mu, into your breath, into the koan, the question. That's all. We resist doing this because of fear. We fear this world of darkness where that is beyond thought. But the irony is that's the very place that is where we need to go for our liberation, is to into what we fear, which is this realm of nothingness, darkness, silence, no thought. For most of us, it takes time. It takes one attempt to do that after another. We start to venture beyond the world of thought, start to get into this clear space. And then, kind of reflexively, we recoil. We come back to those precious thoughts that have filled our mind our whole life. And then we realize that we're still okay, and the thoughts are still pretty unsatisfying. So we then venture again beyond the thoughts and maybe retreat again until eventually we become more familiar with this space of no thought, this realm of no thought. It becomes less frightening because it's less alien, it's less strange to us. And then sooner or later, we develop the faith. Again, faith. It always comes down to faith. Faith in just this oneness with the practice we're working on, which takes us completely beyond thought. He continues, when working on Zen, if one can bring forth the doubt sensation, he is then in conformity with the principle of Dharmakaya, and the whole world turns into a vortex. Immersed in the tossing waves and surging billows, he will enjoy himself greatly. However, when the Zen practitioner reaches this state, he is apt to become attached to this wonderful experience which so fully absorbs him. Thus, she will not progress further. She will not progress further even if pushed, nor will she turn back even if she is pulled down. Consequently, she cannot put all her body and mind into the work. She is like a tramp who has discovered a hill of gold. While knowing it clearly to be gold, she nevertheless cannot take it away with her and enjoy it at will. This is what the old masters called the treasure guard. Such a person is sick through and through. This is not Zen. When one reaches this state, she should disregard danger and death. Only then will she conform with the Dharma. And then he quotes Master Tian Tong. The whole universe becomes like cooked rice. One can dip his nose in the bowl and eat as much as he likes. Rice has this immense significance in Asia. The word for, the character for rice is the same as that for life. This one passage, it's etched in the recesses of my mind from hearing Roshi Kaplo read this paragraph in Taisho. It's so vivid. The whole universe becomes like cooked rice, and you can dip your nose and eat as much as you like. spaghetti would also work. Therefore, if at this stage he cannot do this, it is as though he were sitting beside a rice basket or floating in the ocean. He cannot eat the rice or drink the water. He is hungry and thirsty unto death. Of what use is this? Here, too, he's describing a state of samadhi. You're just completely one. You're embedded in the world. You're held. You're nourished by the world. The world is not apart from you. There is no separation. People in ancient times practiced Zen in a single-minded manner. Their minds were sincerely focused. When they brought forth the doubt sensation, they saw that the mountain was not a mountain and that the water was not water. But they did not bring up any discriminatory reflections or arouse any second thoughts. That's the problem when we do that. Stubbornly and steadfastly they pushed forward, and then suddenly the doubt sensation was broken up and their entire bodies became full of eyes. Then they saw that the mountain was still a mountain and the water was still water. There was not the slightest trace of voidness to be found. From where, then, did all these mountains, rivers, and the great earth itself come? Actually, not a thing has ever existed. When one reaches this state, he must go to the Zen masters, otherwise he is apt to go astray again. Because the wrong path, below the cliff of decaying trees, has still one more branch running from it. If one reaches this state but still continues to work hard for advancement and does not stumble over the decaying trees, I, Poshan, will gladly work with him as my companion and friend in Zen. One last paragraph here. When working on Zen, if one brings forth the doubt sensation, he is in conformity with the principle of the Dharmakaya. Notice the repetition. Of course, we notice the repetition. But that's an age-long device in teaching, at least in Buddhism. The Buddha used a lot of repetition as a way to hammer these points in. It takes that kind of repetition often for us to get it, because we're bound up with all kinds of false conditioning about self and other and every other kind of dualistic notion. We're strapped in these things, and for most of us, it takes repetition. We have to hear this over and over and over again. It's part of the point of chanting. If we chant enough times a text like the Prajnaparamita, Affirming Faith in Mind, or any of them, if we chant them enough times, hundreds of times, thousands of times, these Dharma truths seep into the mind. They fight their way through the resistance, the thought resistance that we have acquired in our lifetime. They water the soil of the mind so that the Dharma can sprout, so we can come to accept this radical truth of non-duality. Again, if one brings forth a down sensation, he is then apt at all times to feel a lightness and ease of body and mind, feeling thoroughly free in all activities and circumstances, and that nothing can hinder him. This, however, is merely the sign of the initial stage of one's meeting with the Tao. It is just the action of the four elements harmonizing within the physical body. Temporary and contingent, it is a state by no means absolute or permanent. So this, again, he's talking about this lightness and ease of body and mind. When uninformed persons reach it, they take it for the great enlightenment, shrug off their doubt sensation, and make no further efforts to advance in the work. Although to some extent able to enter into the truth, they do not realize that the roots of life are still not yet cut out of them. They have not yet gained Zen. They have failed to reach a deep state of truth, such a dry, abstract word. They have failed to reach the way and have turned about too soon. Even though they may possess a deep understanding, they cannot apply it. Even though they have acquired the live remark, they should still continue to cultivate and preserve it in quiet retreats near a river or in a forest. They should never be anxious to become Zen masters at once or allow conceit and pride to rule them. Here he says, even though they've acquired the live remark, footnote 15. The author says the translator says these live remarks are the utterly unintelligible, inexplicable, absurd, and dead-end type of sayings which Zen uses so frequently, while the dead remarks are the intelligible ones. In other words, the common sense. The dead ones are the common sense ones that leave us feeling secure in our understanding. Final few words about the Sesshin. this is where things get interesting. Now, as we're halfway through the fifth day of Sesshin, a lot of torque, Zazen torque, has built up now through the days we've been sitting. And people can do now what they couldn't do earlier in Sesshin because of this momentum that's built up. People who've been to many Sesshins risk thinking that they're stuck in a pattern. I hear this in Doksan. People will report, oh, on day five, I always get into the same thing, or on day six, I always get stuck at such and such. Yes, those things can happen until they don't. Until you've dissolved them, or they've been dissolved through this earnest effort. I remember coming out of my, 10th Sesshin maybe, and having been working fanatically, staying up most of the night and sitting break periods and going to the head monitor and saying, I don't know what else I can do. What else can I do? And he said, just keep on. It's right. Because we're changing. We're a different person every sesshin. Especially having gone to many sesshins, we're changing all the time. There's no self we're stuck with. There are no patterns we're stuck with. Some persist. Some of these patterns, these stuck points, they persist, they repeat, until they don't. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.